From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a satire about politics and media from someone in the know. We talk with Jeff Greenfield. His new satirical novel, The People's Choice, is about the presidential elections. Greenfield is ABC News political and media analyst. The sitcom Ellen starts a new season tonight. We'll meet the star comic Ellen DeGeneres. Film critic Steve Weinberg reviews Jeffrey, the film version of Paul Rudnick's comic play about sex in the age of AIDS. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two productions by director Peter Sellers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Here's an election scenario to think about. What if the president-elect died before the inauguration? The vice president-elect wasn't very bright, and no one really believed he was competent to run the country. Well, that's the starting point of the new political satire called The People's Choice by my guest Jeff Greenfield. His new novel satirizes the media as well as politicians and the electoral process. Greenfield has plenty of personal experiences to draw on. He's political and media analyst for ABC News. He appears regularly on Nightline. Before he became a journalist, he worked as a political speechwriter and consultant. The People's Choice is Greenfield's first novel. I'll let him describe the characters he created who win the election.
The president is a conservative Republican, MacArthur foil, sort of mainstream Republican conservative, and a hard-headed political figure who is realistic enough to know that he has to pick a vice president who will do him no harm, and many of the logical people are not available for various reasons or indictments. So MacArthur Foyle, or Mac Foyle as he is known, turns to a kind of dying breed, a New England patrician moderate liberal named Theodore Pinckney Block, former governor of Connecticut. Very attractive, very photogenic, but a man who one would have to say is cognitively challenged, not the brightest guy in the world, and a guy for whom the English language is a challenge as well. Ted Block talks in a, I'd have to say, kind of Bushian language, and during the presidential campaign, Ted Block proves to be an almost disastrous running mate for Foyle. They barely win the election. The election ends with many people feeling that the new vice president is unfit to run a microwave, much less be second in command.
Some people, as you describe that, will be thinking, is this based on Dan Quayle?
Well, I thought of this idea so long ago, literally Election Day 1980, that I had not heard of Dan Quayle. I will have to say, in all honesty, that Dan Quayle's dilemmas and his reputation and his treatment at the hands of the press made this plot a lot more plausible than when I started out. I had to do two things to make this plot plausible. I had to make the vice president not a good political fit with the president, and that was a little bit like Reagan and Bush. A lot of conservatives didn't trust Bush. And I had to make him not credible as a clear leader when something terrible happens to the president. And I have to say that Dan Quayle made that much more credible.
Okay, so these guys are elected, but then the president is killed in an accident,
yes.
Actually during a photo op. I'm going to let you describe what happens there.
Yes, no, you got it. He dies for a photo opportunity.
Yeah.
he has made a promise to appear in a Western rodeo kind of thing, and he has to break that promise. And his advisors tell him, look, you have to go ride in this rodeo parade. There's lots of children there of various states of physical challenge. You can't not do it. He's never ridden a horse. His advisors convince him he's got to get on a horse. He gets on the horse, and through a series of accidents, the horse dislodges the newly elected president with fatal results. So he's dead. There's no other way to put this, Terry. He's dead.
Okay, we're not going to give away too much about what happens in your book here, but after the president-elect is killed, And then the vice president, who, as you put it, is a little cognitively challenged, is next in line. It really has to go to the Electoral College because they haven't been inaugurated yet.
That's right.
So what's the story here? I mean, what if this happened in real life, what power would the Electoral College have?
Well, in fact, based, you know, I'm a law school graduate who blessedly never had to become a lawyer, but I did a lot of research on this, and the best answer I can give you is it's different in every state what the laws say, but the reality is the electors could do pretty much whatever they darn well pleased. Because however much there are arguments about whether electors have to vote for the candidate they're pledged to, and every once in a while one of them doesn't, if the president candidate, if the presidential candidate is dead, even though the national committee would come into emergency session and fill the vacancy probably with the vice president, they can do, I think, pretty much whatever they want. And the premise of this novel turns on the fact that these electors, or few of them, suddenly get it into their heads that, look, the founding fathers said we were supposed to pick the president. We know what the custom is. We know what the tradition is. But the guy we pledged to vote for, in the words of Monty Python's Dead Parrot sketch, has ceased to be. And it's our game now. So what? So you got 538 people no one ever heard of who now, I think, would under the right circumstances, might take it into their heads to pick the president themselves.
Especially because 60% of the public at this point doesn't believe that the vice president is qualified to be president.
Exactly. And I have to say that you mentioned, Dan Quayle, that in recent history we have had an example of where most people think the guy who was just elected vice president is not qualified to be president. And under those circumstances, particularly if the political fit, if the ideological fit wasn't right, and that's why I had him to be a relatively liberal Republican chosen in an election where most of the Republicans are conservatives, the rank and file would say, you know, we weren't too fond of this guy in the first place. So that's what sets all these wheels in motion and causes nuts and bolts to begin to spring from the political process.
Who are the people in the Electoral College? How do you get in?
They are every kind of person you could imagine. They are. Every state has a different way of picking them. Sometimes these state conventions of the political parties pick the slate. Sometimes the presidential campaigns get to pick their own slate of electors. Sometimes it's the state committee. But basically, they are everyone from campaign contributors to retired politicians. At one point in New York, the spouses of a lot of officials were given this. It was kind of a day trip. Hey, guess what? A month from now, you go up to Albany and you meet the governor and you have a free lunch and you have your picture taken. And that's basically what it is. It's a pageant. It's a reward for faithful political service. It's your footnote in history. And indeed, if I can wrench this back to the book, I have a local woman bank manager who is the heart and soul of the Grand Rapids, Michigan Republican Party. She does all the scut work that other people get credit for. So as a reward one election, they give Dorothy Ledger a place on the electoral slot. And she becomes the first elector to think, you know, I have been so beaten up and manipulated by guys in suits all my life. This is just one I can't take. I'm not going to do it. And she begins to put place the mechanism that's going to throw all this off the road. So there are all kinds of people.
So do you think we should keep the Electoral College?
I think probably in the interest of just simplicity, the best thing to do would be just to go to a straight popular presidential election. But the arguments against that are principally from big states. I mean, it's pretty obvious. If you carry California with one more vote than your opponent, you get all 54 electoral votes and you are 20% of the way home to the White House. Texas, New York, Florida, California have a vested interest in keeping the system because it greatly magnifies the state's power. And since it would have to be changed by a constitutional amendment, generally through the House and Senate, the prospects for that reformer are minimal. I think at a minimum, they ought to abolish the office of elector and make the votes automatic. So you would not put in a situation where you would put into the hands of individuals, under my scenario, the power to just make the whole process go bluey.
Jeff Greenfield is my guest, political and media analyst for ABC News and author of a new political satire, a novel called The People's Choice. Colin Powell is considering running for the presidency, maybe as a Republican, maybe as an independent. Newt Gingrich said the other day, and I'm paraphrasing here, so I hope I get his thought completely straight. He said, you know, you can get elected with the help of television. You don't need the party necessarily to get elected. But if you are elected president as an independent, you have no power in Congress because Congress is a party organization and you have no constituency there and you're going to be lost. Again, this is paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if you think he's right on that.
Well, we have no experience in this, so everybody's flying blind. All I can say is that we have had the experience of independents being elected governors. Weicker in Connecticut, we've had a couple of independents in Maine, we have an independent in Alaska. It is true they have had to cobble together legislative majorities. And it is certainly, since I happen to think that we are now at a point in American politics where an independent could conceivably win the White House, I think what Gingrich is pointing to is the most serious dilemma. That is, if you get elected, then what? And it's why, and now I'm speaking just, you know, as a one-time political operative rather than a journalist in this sense, it would be critically important, I think, to any independent with a chance to win, that candidate set forth as clear an agenda as the candidate's capable of doing. Because under those circumstances, let's say that Powell ran, and let's say that he made campaign finance reform and lobbying reform a key element of his campaign, which, again, as a one-time advisor, I think would be a good idea. If he were to win the White House, I think he would be in a position to go to the Congress and say, look, I was as clear as I could be about what I intended to do and what I wanted you guys to do. I won. You have now a mandate from the people and, in fact, a kind of requirement on your part to do it. I grant you that in the traditional sense, the forging of a legislative agenda would be really hard, but I think the sheer shock of an outspoken independent who ran on a coherent platform and won might be enough to in fact, galvanize the Congress into action. But as Dennis Miller says, I could be wrong.
Several of the Republican candidates seem to think it's very important to have the backing of the Christian Coalition. I say backing knowing that the Christian Coalition isn't going to officially back a candidate. But I wonder if you think the Christian Coalition really has that much power in American politics, or whether people are giving them more power than they really have.
Well, I thought that was true about Reverend Falwell when he first started in 1980 or so. I thought that both his backers and the critics who were raising the cry of alarm about a theocracy were way exaggerating. I think the Christian Coalition is different, largely because their executive director, who is this 33-year-old Ralph Reed, is, I think, a much, much shrewder political player than his antecedents. I mean, he talks very clearly about, I want to pursue traditional ends with libertarian means. He raises far fewer of the red flags to people who are worried than others. I don't mean that people aren't worried about them, but he's broadened the base. They've backed moderate pro-choice Republicans in some states. I think in the Republican primary field, the Christian Coalition is a significant force in the same sense that for many years Labor had a veto power over Democratic nominees, in the same sense that for a time in some states the peace movement in Iowa was in the Democratic Party played a role. I think if the more zealous fringes of the Christian Coalition become the definition of them, then that's real trouble for a Republican nominee who has embraced the coalition in a general election. And I think you have to distinguish that. I think in the Republican Party now, that they are a real player, they are a real force. But they still raise questions on the part of less ideological folk.
My guest is Jeff Greenfield. He's political and media analyst for ABC News, and he has a new political satire just published called The People's Choice. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jeff Greenfield, political and media analyst for ABC News and author of a new political satire called The People's Choice. I've got a Nightline question for you.
Okay.
You've done your share of shows on O.J. Simpson and the trial.
They have, yes.
They have, right. So
I have boycotted that story, but you're right.
Have you?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to, well, why? Why'd you boycott it?
Because there's enough of it. I mean, uh-huh. There's nothing that I could conceivably say about that case that hasn't been said. People all the time say, why don't you do a piece about the media circus? And as I have said elsewhere, whenever you do a piece on the media circus, you got to remember you're one of the clowns.
Mm-hmm.
So I've decided to stay away from it. But certainly, Nightline has covered it a lot.
I've been wondering what the conversations have been like at editorial meetings and deciding how much is enough, how much is too much of the Simpson trial on Nightline.
What happens, I think, is that it's – this is going to sound like a political waffling, but what the heck. because it's, in this case, it's the truth. Every day – the story is looked at and said, do we have to, is this something we have to do? Because it's on the West Coast and because the events go through off until 8:30 at night Eastern time, Nightline becomes the news show of record for that story. If something were to break, something important to that case were to break at 7:30 Eastern time, that's after the evening news. So that the story is looked at every day. And I think, by and large, Nightline has done okay in saying, all right, we're going to do Bosnia tonight, we're going to do Colin Powell tonight, we're going to do this story tonight, but we got to do O.J. Thursday because, or, good heavens, today we learned that Mark Furman, is a stone racist, so we got to do that. The thing about this story that I think is tricky is, in my view, it's not an important story. But it is a totally compelling story. This story, despite the efforts of people to read social significance into it, most of the time it isn't. I think the Mark Furman story is because it tells you, you know, something about the attitude of some cops in this country that's pretty darn disturbing. But it's a story that doesn't carry with it long-term implications. But a high-profile murder case, and this is not because of television, has always been a story that fascinates people. If I can take 1 second here, Terry, back at the turn of the century, a famous architect named Stanford White, who was the former lover of a showgirl named Evelyn Nesbit, was killed by Evelyn Nesbit's rich, degenerate husband, Harry K. Thaw.
This is the story told in the novel and book Ragtime.
Yes, and it was also a movie called The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing. Now, apart from the fact that Evelyn Nesbit then made a career out of going on stage at thousands of dollars a week and singing specialty lyrics about this case, in case we think this celebrities out of trials are new, this story, I think the New York Times said it was one of the most heavily covered stories in the history of the world. Reporters from all over the world were fascinated by it. Pre-radio, pre-television, it was a famous person killing another famous person. And the Lindbergh case, the Lindbergh baby kidnap murder case, you cannot describe the nature of that media circus. With television in the courtroom, all of that becomes magnified. And I'll tell you, there are people of reasonable intelligence and sensibility that I know who are hooked. I mean, they're going to have to go into some kind of a 12-step program when this trial is over because they're not going to do it. So, yeah, that's a long-winded way of saying that Nightline every day debates whether or not the story should, has to be, must be, cannot be covered.
As a media analyst, do you think the O.J. Simpson trial should have been televised?
Well, I really can conflict it. I can't make a constitutional case now that the cameras are unobtrusive. You know, they don't have to put on bright lights like they did during the Lindbergh case when they let press in. If you're going to let the print press in, how do you not let the TV press in? On the other hand, even though this is not in the interest of my employer, I think the presence of cameras in the courtroom does heighten the lunacy. I think there would be slightly or maybe even substantially less coverage of this case if we didn't have the highlights. And I have to tell you, I am not the only journalist who was privately rooting some months ago when Ito was making this threat that he just pulled the plug. I think at the end of the day, it's going to make both the legal profession and the journalism profession come down several notches in the public estimation.
A lot of people I know feel overwhelmed by the amount of information they feel they need to or that they're expected to absorb every day.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they also feel that they're losing their memory.
Yes.
Their ability to absorb that. Yeah.
Both things are very familiar to me.
Are they?
Oh, yeah.
Now, how do you deal with it?
Part of it is that in a very practical way, there's a lot of stuff in the paper that you can read at about 80,000 words a minute because it isn't any different. I mean, great chunks of news stories There's a line from a folk song by a guy named John Prine. He's a wonderful songwriter. And he has a line in one of his songs. I think the line goes, "And all the news repeats itself like some old forgotten dream." I don't think that parses, but that's close. And so when I see a story where, you know, diplomats hopeful on Bosnia Accord, I skip it. Because I've been reading, that story has been around since Chamberlain went to Munich. You don't have to read that story. There are all kinds of stories that I'm not even talking about the fluff. You know, the what's happened is that entertainment news has become so much more part of our news coverage that I really don't have to read about the opening of the latest Planet Hollywood. I mean, and please don't misunderstand me. If there's a nice, juicy sex scandal going on, that's different. But a lot of it is, you know, a lot of the entertainment kind of shows that are on TV. Tonight, we take you backstage, behind, you know, at a new sitcom. Well, thanks. I think I won't go. And it's the same thing is true on the political stuff. Believe it or not, I don't read polls at this stage very often. Because one of the few good lines Saturday Night Live has gotten off in the last several years was where their anchor said, in a recent poll today, 80% of Americans said if the election were held today, they'd be really surprised. And I think this may sound like a terrible confession to you. I have not yet been to Iowa or New Hampshire, and right. I will not go for, what is this, September? I'm not going for another 3 months at least. It's too early.
Okay, now before we run out of time, mm-hmm. The memory question, what do you do to retain things that you do need to know?
Well, first of all, the ABC News research operation is the best in the business, and luckily, I don't have to.
They retain it for you.
They retain it for me, and that's that. But the other answer is, I guess it's like being an idiot savant. There are certain things, and they generally are things about things that happen in politics that are a little off the beaten path that I work most hard on retaining, like the flap over Lamar Alexander's flannel shirt. I thought that was wonderful. He announced for president. He wanted to show he was a man of the people. He wore a flannel shirt. And the reporters were so outraged by this example of manipulation that they all called it Flannelgate. Now, that, you know, that tells us something. I'm not quite sure what, but it tells us something both about the pretensions of political wannabes and the faux outrage of the press. You know, they strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. This is what got our dander up. Not the ceaseless pandering left and right, not the avoidance of some, you know, rather basic issues like violence in American life and what's happened to the income of blue-collar Americans. This is the one we're going to spend an hour talking about. So I filed that one away, and I'll remember that one even if I can't remember where I'm supposed to be tomorrow night.
Well, Jeff Greenfield, a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff Greenfield is political and media analyst for ABC News. His new novel is a political satire called The People's Choice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The comedy Jeffrey is the latest indication that Hollywood has indeed gone a little gay. Lots of stars appear in this Hollywood movie, adapted by Paul Rudnick from his hit stage play about sex in the age of AIDS. Guest film critic Steve Weinberg has this review.
The gay comedy Jeffrey has a ticklish, tinsely charm. The title character, played by Steven Weber, is so freaked out by the prospect of sex in the age of AIDS that he opts for celibacy. Then, naturally, he meets the man of his dreams, Steve, Mark T. Weiss, who's HIV positive. That's the premise. And from it, the writer, Paul Rudnick, a adapting his stage play, strings a collection of bits, blackout sketches, on the themes of Jeffrey's desire and his sexual paranoia. Sigourney Weaver shows up in the most uproarious one, in a blinding white suit, as a TV celebrity billed as the nation's hottest postmodern evangelist. Swinging her mic like a shot put, she exhorts her live audience to get out their aggressions on the loved ones who've mistreated them. Beaming at her own streamlined technique, Weaver's like Mac the Knife as a New Age therapist. Her chief target is Kathy Najimy, smiling desperately, her hair done up like a broomstick.
It sounds to me like you've got a problem with everybody's favorite.
Low self-esteem.
Of course, I don't know you. Maybe you should have low self-esteem.
I just really want a relationship.
You want a relationship?
Because you're afraid.
Right. It all goes back to mother, doesn't it? Did you love your mother?
Yeah, I guess.
Don't lie to me.
Okay.
I'll call her.
Right.
Did she withhold?
Well.
Was there abuse?
No, I don't.
Dig deep.
Yes, definitely. Yes.
Go see her.
Okay.
Tell her.
Mom.
You were chilly.
Yeah, chilly.
You forgot my birthday. You beat me with a baseball bat. But I understand. I forgive.
I
love you.
I love you.
And Mom. Now you're old.
Oh, God.
You've got a plastic hip. And I've got the bat!
When it comes to dramatizing anything, Rudnick is hopeless. He simply turns maudlin. He resorts to the same cliches Broadway's homosexual characters have been spouting since the coming out monologue in A Chorus Line, a nauseous mix of gay pride and gay masochism. And Steven Weber, as a man who hangs on the sidelines, paralyzed, has nothing to play. None of the actors who are stuck working through the actual plot of Jeffrey ever gets unstuck. Mark T. Weiss, Brian Batt as a chorus boy with AIDS, even Patrick Stewart as Jeffrey's best pal and interior decorator. Weiss does have a nifty come-on style, though, and Stewart, sleekly stage-trained, gets off some well-heeled epigrams. That's what Rudnick is gifted at. He writes sharper one-liners than any of the other gay playwrights currently on the scene. And director Christopher Ashley uses the right deluxe birthday bash approach to the material. He's not great at staging, but he's full of colorful pop ideas like throwing a little Busby Berkeley into a hoedown sequence. The high society hostess of the hoedown, an AIDS benefit, is Christine Baranski of TV's Sybil. And plenty of other talented actors show up in cameos. Nathan Lane is a gay priest who gooses Jeffrey as he genuflects. Deborah Monk is Jeffrey's mother dispersing frank sexual advice while she putters about the kitchen. And Kevin Nealon is a straight newscaster, ill at ease covering a gay march. The best joke of all is a running gag. Jeffrey and his friends live in a virtually all-gay world, where waiters and clothing salesmen feel free to put in their 2 cents worth. The guest stars seem to be having a splendid time, and the combination of their generosity and the steady good humor of the film give Jeffrey a sweet spirit. Even the sentimentality doesn't wreck the party.
Steve Weinberg writes about film for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at College of the Holy Cross. The sitcom Ellen starts its new season tonight. My guest is the star of the show, Ellen DeGeneres. She plays a bookstore owner named Ellen, who's in her 30s, single, with the requisite number of neurotic and annoying friends. Here's a scene with her best friend, Paige. Ellen is all packed for the getaway ski trip they've planned, but Paige walks in the door, throws all the winter clothes out of Ellen's valise, and lets Ellen know the travel plans are changed.
I'm helping you pack. We're going to the Golden Valley Center for health and relaxation.
Going to an old age home?
It's a spa, the most exclusive spa in California. You need to book a year in advance. My boss had reservations, and he's not going, so we get him.
Where's your boss going?
Skiing. Come on, it'll be great. I mean, you said yourself that you wanted to start exercising more and eating right.
That's just something I say when I'm on hold for Domino's.
Come on, all the big stars go there. Michelle Pfeiffer and Bridget Fonda love it. We'll come out looking like them.
Paige, they went in looking like them.
Come on, we'll get massages and skin treatments. They'll pamper us. They will cater to our every whim.
Well, I do like my whims catered. My last whim was a buffet style, which wasn't bad, but I prefer a sit-down whim. It's just somehow classier. Come on, let's go. This is one of those situations where I fight and fight and you still get your way?
Of course.
All right. But you're driving.
No, you have to drive.
Okay.
Like so many hit sitcoms, Ellen is built around an actor who started off as a stand-up comic. And like several comics turned actors, she has a book. It's called Ellen, My Point and I Do Have One. And last weekend, it was number one on the Sunday Times bestseller list. Ellen DeGeneres told me how she started her career as a stand-up comic.
The first time was in New Orleans, and it was probably 81, something like 1981, in New Orleans for a benefit, some people trying to raise some money for some legal function. I don't know what it was, and they didn't have any access to talent or anything, and they just were just putting stuff on stage. Someone had a band, and someone else probably made balloon animals. I don't even remember at this point. And they asked me to get up on stage because I had always been funny around them, and they thought, well, just get up on stage and be funny. And at this time, I guess Steve Martin was doing comedy, and you know, there was comedy, but it wasn't nearly like it was in the last 10 years. And I didn't know what to do. I got on stage and I ate, this is when I was eating red meat. I ate a Whopper, fries, and a shake. And I basically said that I didn't have time to eat all day because I was so nervous because this was my first time on stage. So if you don't mind, I just need to eat really quickly. And I tried to get a sentence out. You know how people start when you're like having lunch with them and they start to tell you something and then they take a huge bite and then they hold their finger up like you just 1 second while they swallow. And it's like, why did you even start the sentence if you're going to take a bite? And then they start the sentence again and then they take a sip or they take another. And so I did that on stage for as long as it took me to eat a Whopper, fries, and a shake. And I didn't say anything the whole time. And then I looked at my watch and said, my time's up, thank you, good night. And that was what I did on stage the first time.
How'd it go over?
It was, I don't remember. I mean, I just
kind of... You're too busy eating.
I ate the whole time. I don't know. It was good enough that someone who booked a college in New Orleans saw me and asked if I would go on stage and do something there. And I decided I should stop eating because this really would not be a good career to eat on stage all the time. And unless you're like just performing once a month. So I started writing material, and I'm sure some of it was really, really bad. But at the time, it was, you know, just like bell bottoms were popular at one time. Maybe the material will come back again. Bell bottoms have. So, I just kept writing material, and it just kind of fell into my lap.
What kind of material were you writing early on?
It was bad. There was just really bad. Well, one of the first things I ever wrote was The Phone Call to God, and that was the piece that got me on The Tonight Show, and Johnny Carson asked me to sit down on the couch, and I was the first and only woman that's ever been invited on the first appearance. So the piece that I wrote early in my career turned out to be, you know, something that, and I knew when I wrote it that it was going to get me there.
For our listeners who haven't heard it, could you tell us something about it?
The Phone Call to God is actually I wrote this out of a very, very depressing time in my life. My best friend at the time and someone I was living with was killed in a car accident, and I happened to be driving home that night and I saw the accident, but she was in another car, so I didn't know it was her. And stopped and looked at the accident and went, oh, my God, because it had just happened. There weren't even, the fire engine was just getting their ambulances. And I looked at it and I just was like, oh, God, that's horrible. And then found out the next morning that it was her. And she was beautiful and talented and had dreams and hopes and was 23 years old. And I was 21 years old. And I thought, you know, and I was living at the time, we were splitting a place that I couldn't afford anymore on my own, so I moved into this horrible basement apartment in New Orleans. It was freezing in the winter and hot in the summer, and there were fleas everywhere. And I wrote, I just started thinking about why she was gone. I thought, how can someone so beautiful and so such an addition to this world be taken away at 23 years old, and there are fleas here. I just didn't understand it. So I started writing what it would be like to to call God and ask God a question like this. And so it was a one-sided conversation of me, and I get put on hold, first of all, and I listen to Muzak, which is Onward Christian Soldiers, and just he makes fun of my name, and or she, depending on how you take it. And, you know, it's just this whole one-sided conversation about asking why fleas are here. And it's basically, the point of it is not the end of it, which is that there are so many people employed by the flea collar industry. That's the answer that I get. But that's not really what the point of the conversation is. It's just kind of what it would be like to call God. So that's what I wrote, and I wrote it in like 10 minutes. And I read that, and I thought, I'm doing this on Johnny Carson one day. I know I'm going to do this. I mean, in this horrible apartment, I'm sitting on the floor thinking I'm going to do this on Johnny Carson. And when it actually happened, and when Johnny Carson called me to sit down and loved the piece, it was just, it was surreal.
My guest is Ellen DeGeneres, star of the sitcom Ellen, and author of the new book, Ellen, My Point, and I Do Have One. We're after a break. This is Fresh Air. Ellen DeGeneres is my guest, star of the TV series Ellen. She now has a new book called Ellen DeGeneres, My Point, and I Do Have One. What was the circuit that you played early on?
Clubs or restaurants sometimes. Well, you know, comedy got to be, it replaced the mechanical bull. So, you know, it was like whatever was going to make somebody money, they put it in wherever you could fit it. I mean, I really thought that at some point Macy's was going to have like a little section where you could just go watch comedy before you buy shoes. Wherever you can make money, people will do it. So here are these guys that have no idea what comedy is, what art is. You know, they have a pizza parlor and they decide, you know, yeah, we'll get a couple of comedians in here and we'll fill the place on Tuesday night. And usually it's not filled on Tuesday night. So, you know, and maybe cheese pizza will be, you know, $2. And so I was playing some horrible, I played places that, now I talk about my book, that I actually showed up, we drove from, it was like some guy, I didn't even know who he was, we were just kind of assigned to work together, and we drove to this place, and in front of the restaurant, there's like a chalkboard on the sidewalk, and it says, soup of the day, whatever it was, you know, cream of asparagus, and Ellen DeGeneres. That was, and like, so soup of the day had top billing. I mean, I didn't even rank above the soup. And so people had to really want that soup in order to come in. And then if they wanted to see me, they got to see me as well. And it was like this long, narrow, you know, not, I think the stage was maybe like a couple of cases of beer with a piece of plywood on top. And I had, you know, some kind of horrible microphone that kept feeding back the whole, ooh, every other word you couldn't hear. It was horrible.
Now, I think your brother's in show business, too, right?
Yeah, he's a writer and producer.
Now, I think your brother had a band when you were growing up?
He was in a band called The Cold in New Orleans, and they were huge. They were tremendous. I was always Vance DeGeneres' sister. That's what I was known as.
Did you envy him because he got to perform?
Yes. I thought, God, everybody knows who he is, and he's just so cool, and he was like the heartthrob of the band. They always called him the sex symbol. He was just, I mean, my brother is just very, very good-looking and talented, and, you know, being on stage anyway, being in a band, you know, so it was really, I thought, God, I wish I could sing, I wish I could, and for a while I thought I could sing, and I thought about becoming a singer, and you know, because there are a lot of people out there that are singing and they can't really sing. So I thought, well, I can do that too.
So were you competitive with each other, you and your brother?
No, not at all. I mean, the only time it was uncomfortable is sometimes at Thanksgiving or Christmas or whenever the whole family would get together, everyone would be doting over Vance. Everybody would be talking about Vance and how proud they were of Vance. And, you know, and I was, at the time, I had a different profession every week. I painted houses for a while. I was a waitress. I was a bartender. I shucked oysters. I sold vacuum cleaners. I was an employment counselor. I mean, I didn't know what I was going to do. So no one really, it was almost a sore subject. Let's not ask Ellen what she does. You know, and nobody talked to me. I was at the card table all by myself, you know, and everybody is going on and on about Vance. So that was the only uncomfortable time that I wanted somebody to talk about me and be proud of me, of what I was doing.
Ellen DeGeneres is my guest, and she has a new book. Now, who taught you the facts of life?
Nobody. That's why I try in my book to teach you how to explain sex to your child, because nobody taught me. And as you read in my book, I still don't know how to teach anybody. It's just sort of a kind of spirals out of control. But nobody did. I think I remember hearing girls talk about it in a bathroom. And it was kind of late. I was a late bloomer for everything. I was in seventh grade when I heard about it for the first time, what happens.
How'd you hear about it?
In the bathroom. I heard girls, you know, talking about it. And
did you believe it?
Well, I asked my mother how long it has to stay in. She was shocked by that question. I mean, it was, to me, it the way it was described, it sounded like, you know, going to a gas station and putting the pump into the gas tank and just leave it there until the tank is full, and then you remove it and you pay the cashier. That's exactly what I pictured. I really just thought, well, wow, that's a shame that that has to happen. And so no one really, I mean, I remember asking my mother that question, like, how long does it have to stay in? And I think she said, not very long. And then that was it. That was our whole discussion of the mother-daughter talk.
Well, you not only have a best-selling book now, but you're opening in a new film soon called Mr. Wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us something about your character and the storyline.
The character's name is Martha Alston. And she is it's hard to say because I haven't seen a rough cut of the movie yet, and it depends on how they put it together. But basically what the story was is she has, like most women, been brought up to believe in fairy tales. She's reading Snow White, and it's all about someday my prince will come. And she meets who she thinks is the guy that she has been wanting to meet, you know, all her life. And Bill Pullman plays this character. And it turns out that he is not what he appears at all, and just is a huge goon, just embarrassing, and says inappropriate things and does inappropriate things, and just an idiot. And she tries, you know, after she's slept with this guy and after she's fallen so hard, to back out of this and get away from him. And he does not get it. He just will not let her go. And
This is a comedy, right?
Yeah, it's a comedy, but it's sort of dark. It's mm-hmm. It was a lot darker before when I just read the script. It was a lot darker. It got a little lighter. But it's really it's hysterical, and it's something that I think everybody can relate to, and it's going to be the feel good movie of the year.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
You had said you know it's going to depend on how the film is edited. I had actually read that they weren't sure whether they were going to edit in a happy ending or an unhappy ending.
Well, it's not that there's an unhappy. I mean, to me, there are two different endings. And one, she ends up with someone else. I won't say who because I don't want to give the story away. But one where she ends up alone and going off into the sunset, and one where she ends up with someone else. And it's not necessarily romantically connected with someone else, but just with someone else. And I strongly am fighting for that she ends up alone, that's the whole message of the movie. And so I was telling the studio, I think that she should end up alone. And they're going to test it. They always test it with audiences. And if they test it and if the audiences want her to end up with someone else, that's what it will be.
Well, Ellen DeGeneres, thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Terry.
Ellen DeGeneres has a new book called My Point, and I do have one. Her sitcom, Ellen, starts its new season tonight. This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has been following the career of director Peter Sellers for a decade and a half. Since Sellers has moved to Los Angeles, however, Lloyd has had less opportunity to see his work. A new Sellers videotape and a recent Sellers production at Lincoln Center provide some insight into what Sellers has been up to.
Peter Sellers launched his career with a series of extremely exciting and very controversial productions of operatic classics by Mozart and Handel, in which he superimposed, some people would say merely imposed, on the score a layer of contemporary images. Don Giovanni in an urban ghetto, The Marriage of Figaro in the Trump Tower. Sellers' work is far above the merely hack, hey, let's set Hamlet in Vietnam mentality, because it contends with emotional and intellectual complexities productions usually ignore. Unlike most opera directors, Sellers has also been active in the creation of new works. He was at the center of the contemporary opera that has most caught the public imagination, Nixon in China, with music by minimalist composer John Adams and a striking libretto by poet Alice Goodman. Sellers' latest venture is Berkeley poet and professor June Jordan's earthquake romance, I Was Looking at the Ceiling and Then I Saw the Sky. The title comes from something someone said after the L.A. earthquake. It's a loosely structured series of scenes dealing with seven multicultural 20-somethings at the time of the quake. Unfortunately, Jordan's characters are merely contemporary cliches. Ethnic, racial, and gender stereotypes far more cardboard than anything in traditional opera. A much pregnant, undocumented alien from El Salvador. A horny black minister. A homophobic Irish cop who's really gay. A ruthless woman TV news reporter and a nervous Vietnamese lawyer who falls in love with her right after she tells him to take a boat back to Vietnam. John Adams' rock, blues, and rap score has a couple of pretty tunes and a good beat, but it's less exciting than the originals by Aretha Franklin or Leonard Bernstein he's imitating. Even Sellers is at a loss to make this material come to life, though the staging, with colorful drops by actual graffiti artists, is Broadway glossy. The audience my night was impressively multicultural, but it upset me that they were applauding the very impulse of ethnic and gender pigeonholing that's at the root of all prejudice. Sellers' new video of Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht's The Seven Deadly Sins is another story. Weill's first score after he was forced by the Nazis to leave Germany in 1933 is one of his most ravishing transformations of the pop music he's imitating. This has suddenly become his most popular work. Some half dozen recordings with big stars on major labels have been released or re-released in just the past few years. This ironic morality tale about sin and family values says that anything is sinful if it keeps you from making a buck. Things like art or sex, for example. Sound familiar? In the main characters, two sisters, who are really two sides of the same person, Sellers shows us hopeless, homeless, uprooted American travelers living in their fantasy of success. His star is the extraordinary Teresa Stratus, who sings the music in Weill's original high key and whose heartbreakingly beautiful but ravaged face Sellers wisely keeps the camera glued to. And in the casting of the exquisite African-American dancer Nora Kimball as her sister and the superb male quartet who sings the family, including beefy bass Peter Rose as the mother, Sellers, following Brecht and Weill, make subtler, stronger, and more subversive arguments against stereotyping than can be found anywhere in I Was Looking at the Ceiling. Here he fulfills one of the most important functions of art, to let us, or make us, see the unique soul of every individual, not to take that individuality away.
Yeah.
Lloyd Schwartz is the classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. The video of Weill's Seven Deadly Sins, directed by Peter Sellers, is on London. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown, publisher of A Place Called Freedom, a new novel from Ken Follett. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A rocket-propelled grenade crashed into the U.S. Embassy in Moscow today. It punched through a wall and into a photocopy machine. No one was hurt. No one has claimed responsibility either, and the White House has denounced the attack. Russian officials aren't speculating on the reasons for the attack. It comes as anti-American sentiment is high because of NATO airstrikes on the Bosnian Serbs. Meanwhile, the Clinton administration is trying to heal a rift with Russia over these airstrikes. Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot is in Moscow on a diplomatic mission. Assistant Secretary Richard Holbrooke has returned to Serbia. Russia has accused NATO of genocide against Bosnian Serb children. The Pentagon rejects the charge. Defense Secretary William Perry says he has personally reviewed bomb damage at more than 100 targets hit by NATO warplanes. He says he sees no evidence of any civilian casualties. President Clinton has marked the first anniversary of his crime bill by speaking out against juvenile crime. He stopped off at a Maryland middle school today to tell the students he's sick and tired of youth-on-youth shootings and violence. He also discussed a new report from the Health and Human Services Department that finds marijuana use is up amongst youths. He says this has got to be stopped.
Apparently, more and more young people don't think it's bad for you. Well, it's wrong, it's illegal, it's dangerous, it's a horrible first step, and we have got to turn that number around. And that's one big reason I am here today with young people who know it and are prepared to say it.
President Clinton also pointed out that while overall crime in the nation is down, violent crime committed by young people is still at an all-time high. Britain's Serious Fraud Office says that it will not seek the extradition of Nicholas Leeson. He's the traitor blamed for the billion-dollar collapse of Barings Bank. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The Serious Fraud Office announced its decision after 6 days of interviews with Nick Leeson in his prison cell in Frankfurt, Germany. The 28-year-old trader was arrested there in March as he tried to return to England from Singapore, where he ran Barings Futures trading operation. He's admitted to hiding trading losses there and getting Barings' home office in London to send him more money to try and recoup them. The Singapore government is anxious to have Leeson extradited from Germany to stand trial. Today's decision by the Serious Fraud Office means it's likely that Leeson will be tried in Singapore, although his lawyer said that he would continue to fight to have Leeson tried in Britain. Leeson fears he will be subjected to a show trial in Singapore. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen more than 2 points to 4,749. Trading is very heavy. The Nasdaq is up a fraction of a point at 1,065. This is NPR. Federal aviation officials are seeing a calmer day at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport. Controllers at the Aurora, Illinois Flight Control Center are using the main computer today. The primary computer failed yesterday, throwing flight schedules off for hundreds of planes. It's the sixth time in a year controllers who guide air traffic for O'Hare and other airports in a six-state region have had to struggle with a major computer foul-up. Officials held dozens of planes headed for Chicago at their originating airports. FAA officials insist the computer system is safe with a backup. Published reports say the American Red Cross is seeking to tone down the content of its AIDS prevention program, reportedly at the behest of the organization's president, Elizabeth Dole. Craig Windham reports.
The New York Times reports Mrs. Dole asked to have the Red Cross Board of Governors consider altering the materials at a time when her husband, Senator Bob Dole, is trying to boost his appeal to conservatives in his quest for the presidency. The board chairman, Norman Augustine, says Mrs. Dole was motivated not by politics but by her personal concern that some of the material designed for the campaign may have been too sexually explicit. The board asked for more emphasis to be placed on individual responsibility in preventing AIDS and suggested that illustrations of sexual organs in a handout on condoms be redrawn in a more clinical fashion. The Times says Red Cross officials at various chapters around the country have been complaining about the delay the review has caused in the release of the AIDS prevention campaign. The Red Cross AIDS program is being financed with a $5 million federal grant. I'm Craig Windham in Washington.
The Labor Department is reporting good news on consumer inflation. The agency says consumer prices rose just 0.1% last month. There were big declines in the prices of gasoline and airline tickets. Officials say inflation at the consumer level is rising at an annual rate of 2.8%. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.